Welcome to Not Work Storytelling. This is the show where we untangle our myths and reweave our stories, one age-old tale at a time. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, a coach for writers and creative entrepreneurs, and the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber on Substack. In my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, you'll receive bonus content related to the stories on the show and deep dives into how mythology and folklore can help heal the individual and the collective in the present moment and beyond. There's a link in the show notes to follow Myth is Medicine on Substack, or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 5, Episode 2, Octon, A Brave Mother's Tale, featuring a story by Karina Tynan called Wolves, Horses, and a Small King. Our guest storyteller, Karina Tynan, is a psychotherapist and the author of two collections of retellings from Irish mythology. Tán, The Woman's Stories, offers a new lens on the great Irish epic, the Tán Bo Cúaigne, or the Cattle Raid of Cooley. She is also the author of She, Stories from the Women in Irish Mythology, all of which are linked through the presence of the goddess in her many manifestations. Karina's interest in Irish mythology began almost 30 years ago through the Bard Summer School, which commences each July on Clare Island in County Mayo in Ireland. Each year, the summer school explores an Irish myth for its contemporary relevance. Both of Karina's books are illustrated by Karina's daughter, the artist Kathy Tynan, and designed by Karina's niece, Ruby Henderson. Karina's books are sold in bookshops around Ireland and can be ordered worldwide when you visit Karina's website, karinatynan.com. Also, find Karina on Instagram at Irish Myths Retold. One note before we dive into this episode. About halfway through our conversation, we briefly mentioned suicidal ideation, particularly related to children. Well, I am so excited to welcome Karina Tynan to Not Work Storytelling. As is our way on the podcast, we first ask the story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore all the ways that it resonates and still matters. So, Karina, will you tell us the story?
I would be honored, Marisa, and thank you for having me. This is a story sort of in the middle of the book that sort of introduces another myth cycle, which is the Finn cycle. And this is the story of, I've called it Wolves, Horses, and a Small King. It's the story of Octon, mother of Cormac MacArt, whose long reign as High King at Tara was one of plenty and fairness. Octon protected her child's future from the many perils that might have been the death of him. It's important to know that Cormac was the king who reigned throughout the time of Finn MacCool and the Fianna. There are some that are possible to love before they are known. That was the case with him, whose smile lived in the blue of his eyes, whose hair whitened by the sun curled like the sea when the wind blew it into ripples. His bones, his muscles, his veins made his clothing seem flimsy. He was a king who walked the earth knowing that his time here was but a part of his spirit's life. And so he walked with wisdom and sacrifice. He knew that gain for his people often meant loss for himself. He knew when to lift a sword and when to put it down. That was the way then, and like now, the great design was at work. I am Octon, a druid's child who lived in a village in the province of Connacht. On the outskirts of our village, we had a sacred grove surrounded by trees that was a place for communion with the other world. Art came to our grove, and it was from his time spent there that he came to know what his destiny would be. He would meet his enemy, Louis Macon, whose sword he would die upon at the Battle of Mae Macrumma. He knew this because he could go into himself in a way that included the patterns around him, to listen for the voices of heaven and earth to tell him. We would never have met but for the sick mare I had taken to the grove. Usually on such a fine summer day, I would have been teaching the children to dream with the bees. If we dream with a creature, we will never fear it. So we will never try to kill it unless in sacrifice to bring better to the rest. That day, led by my dear old cob, I entered the grove as Art was harrowing his plight. And along with my presence came his answer. All his doubt was blotted out, the way trees hide the sun to show what lies in the shade. It was not a love of possession. We didn't need to conquer each other with games or to possess for fear of loss. It was simply that I knew him like I know the morning. I welcomed him with the song of morning, and the goddess breathed into my soul as he entered me with his seed. And the dolmen screamed, and the sun pirouetted. Later, when we parted, we knew we had completed for ourselves a sacred day. And as we said goodbye, the moon hung her jaw at the splendor of our ending. Art gave me more than a child. He gave me a king to carry, and he placed the destiny of his people in my heart. He gave me a ring and a sword for our son that I knew would be the symbol of his identity. As he rode away to battle, I knew he would be killed, and the world would go wrong for a time. The druids chanted as I gave birth to our son, calling on the goddess with prayers so he could be safely taken from my body and into his destiny. When he came, the moon turned to blue. A crack of thunder awakened the birds. The hedges rustled with life and the wolves howled as he suckled his first milk. Then my father began weaving the weaving of circles, protections for a little king, vulnerable in a crooked world. The grove was alight. A fire had been lit in a circle around Cormac, son of Art, with his father's ring of identity on his little belly as he underwent 5 spells of protection. The first was a safety spell from burning. Smoke from the circle of fire blotted out the night sky, making the grove the brightest star of the evening. Inside the circle, wet rowan branches were placed around the baby while he was washed with water from our sacred spring. The druids who had come from other villages, even some from other provinces, stood in a circle inside the fire, chanting and weaving safety against ever burning for Cormac MacArt. Then a gaggle of crones came in from the village. They danced the circle to stamp out the fire before taking their places around the baby, facing out toward the world. A bigger circle surrounded them, representing masked evil who shouted slander and curses, spitting venom and stink. The old hags were unmoved because right down inside them, they were connected to the goddess, needing little for life but earth itself. So my child was protected from sorcery. Later, a circle of blunt swords surrounded him while his sword and the staff of his grandfather crossed his cradle to protect him from wounding. And a song of peace was sung to the goddess, assuring her that this was a king to walk in harmony with the natural world, if she would in turn protect his life. The druid put a newt to his tongue and his ears till he wailed with the pinch of its bite. Then the newt was stabbed and tied to a staff of ash. The druid wove it in circles over Cormac, splashing the blood around him to protect him from every drowning. A final spell was protection from wolves. For that, a human sacrifice was made to appease them. She was old and ready, privileged to go to the other world while offering her life for a king who would do good. A circlet was made for the child containing her hair mingled with the hair of a wolf. For protection from wolves, he would carry their scent every day for the rest of his life. I brought my baby everywhere so he could be near my breast. When I tended bees, he was with me. When I gathered herbs, he was with me. When I milked cows, he was with me. When I rode my faithful mare, he was with me. I knew he would have no fear if I had none. I could teach him my ways without ever having to give him a lesson, show him how to walk the earth if I walked it well myself. One very fine day, I took him to the sacred grove because I had work to do. There had been a ritual of prayer the day before to stop the honey from crystallizing in the combs. The fluidity of honey was important for the making of mead, and the bees were my business. I left Cormac down in the center of the grove. I thought he would delight in the patterns the treetops were making against the sun. I left my maid to watch. I cleaned the altar, and when I returned, the girl was fast asleep, and my baby was gone. Think of a savage beast cornered that has no option but to kill. Think of a wailing wraith that will never know heaven. Think of a snake full of hatred for the man standing on his tail. Think of meeting all of these at once. That is what I met in myself without my son. I ranted. I screamed. I threatened. I pounded, but nothing was of any use. I ran. I shook. I raged. I prayed. He was stolen from me. I ran for nights. I ran myself into exhaustion. I had no thought for myself. My well-being did not matter. Only my son mattered, and if he were not a king, he was already one to me. The wolves had heard his name, and though my father gave his own hound in sacrifice, nothing brought him back. To be separated from my baby with his milk going sour in my breasts was the worst cruelty I have ever suffered. But I never gave up hope, because I knew he was alive. The trees knew he was alive. I could hear him on the wind. Ranting, painful time passed until he was found by a trapper called Lou, who knew the forest and was so quiet he could pass through it like a ghost. His feet were as light as a being from the other world. I think he was one of them, living still among the trees. He came upon a large cavern within a very old oak tree in a nearby forest. And there, playing with a litter of pups, was my little Cormac. Were his protections a mistake? Had the scent protected him but also included him in their circle? Would he be challenged by all his protections, or is it simply that the animals had claimed him as their king too? Lou brought him back, but everything had changed. I had been jolted from the luxury of being an ordinary mother. I had to think for a king. My child was prey. The wolves had protected him from the illusion that all would be well for him as he grew up in the land of Louis Macon, who had killed and usurped his father. I awoke to the fact that there was no way Cormac could be raised on the milk and honey of my world. I had to leave. I knew that Art's foster father, Fiachna Casson, lived in Ulster. We would be safe there, but only if no one knew where he had gone. There would be no stately journey for my little king as he passed through the provinces. There were too many dangers. I knew that. I had seen it, and not just from the slaying of the father of my child. I had seen it in abundance, oppositeness, as if it is the way to rule, as if options are not countless, as if magic does not exist. I had seen men fighting duels for lust, possessions, and power. My baby was in danger. The wolves had told me. I set out for the completion of my part. I knew how to walk the earth as her guest. I knew the songs of welcome for the morning and the dirge for the end of every day. I knew how to make decisions, not only for myself, but for my great-grandchildren. My well ran deep. The sun was in my heart, but I did not know how I would walk through the forests of Ireland with an infant child and only myself to trust. I brought with me the sword, the ring, skins, soft cloth to keep my child warm, and my senses as acute as they were. I could not take my horse. A woman with a small child on a horse would be too easily seen. I would have to creep through Ireland with my little king in a sling. A forest is not a wasteland. It is rich with life of every kind. But as I walked the oak woods of Middle Ireland, there was such a wasteland in my heart that the trees might have been marble pillars and every leaf a piece of ice. I had left my warm life behind, my mother and father, the children I taught, the people, animals I loved, and the summer flowers I was waiting to see dancing under the sun. I could see my father taking it silently, my mother trying to reach him, lonely for his company because he carried his position so heavily. They would suffer alone, knowing that I was leaving my life behind to be a wet nurse to a future king. I knew when I went to a kingdom that had suffered from too much war, my child would be protected. But I would not. Oh, I would be protected by their ramparts, but not with prayers to the sun. Not by my own father, my own mother, my own belonging. I walked for days. I travelled on. I crept for nights. I slept in crevices and cracks. I barely touched the earth for fear of waking the wolves. I held back my song. I held back my lament. It was by the shores of Loch Ree that I lay down. We had emerged from a long forest walk. 4 days in all. I had slept little. Cormac had slept at my breast when he needed to. He was getting heavier and stronger by the day, and my strength was waning. Then, on the edge of the lake, with neither a way across nor back that seemed reasonable, I fell into lament. My child was as energetic as ever. All my energy was spent. And I still had a lake to cross. I wondered why I ever thought that I could do this, one who had always had the support of a mother, a father, and a whole community. Now I was at the mercy of every danger nature could provide. I had walked the earth in its glory within a pattern, but then I was outside it, with nothing but my wits and waning physical strength to rely upon. My legs were tired and wounded and stung. I was lost. This could be any lake. How was I to know where I was? A voice inside my head said, go to the other side. I didn't know if I could trust it. I might have been mad with tiredness. I had seen it before, fellows coming home, overcome by the cold or the viciousness of battle, not knowing their own minds. Flies were buzzing around my head, landing on my child. I wanted to scream at flies, me who could dream with the bees. I had never known such tiredness. I needed sleep, but that was not a luxury I could give to myself. While a spirited toddler was playing beside a lake, I continued as doggedly as I have done many a time since, and there were no magic boats. There were no golden bridges, no gods with magical wings, only two tired, sore feet to carry my little boy around the lake through flies and reeds lashing at my legs and a lament in my heart to everything I was leaving for an uncertain greater good. I was never less sure. I got to the other side. Night had fallen. I made my way to a hilltop. The moon lit the scene. I fell right there on the spot with exhaustion. And with no other shelter except for the moon and the warmth of a sleeping child at my breast, I slept, mothered for the night. She gave me the heat I needed, so when I awoke with the dawn, I was as replenished as a crystal is by pure moonlight. Then, as morning came, so did those who had claimed him before. Surrounding us and closing in was a large pack of red furred wolves. Threateningly slow, creeping, heads low, eyes of fire holding their stare, fangs bare. They would kill me to have him back. I knew this. To them, he was wolf. I was food. The sun was rising. I looked to the sun. Then I heard my father say, "You have everything when you have yourself." So I put my heart into my hands. I put my child into my hands. I raised them up over my head and prayed for wings. I wished to be blown away. Some bird might take my heart and my child and leave the rest of me. I didn't mind so long as he had my heart. And still they approached, slowly, surely. Would they charge? I prayed for wings, wishing to be a bird woman, but still they came. A red wave of wolves all around us, promising themselves my flesh and my blood. Until I heard it. Faint at first, then rolling like thunder. The earth was shaking from the outside in. They circled the wolves, horses. Where had so many horses come from? White, roan, dun, black, bay, manes blowing, making them like waves. And it was deafening. My prayer was answered, but not with wings. Nature had her own design. The wolves began to depart. The scene was incredible. Horses circled the hill, spiraling their way to us as the wolves tore away, graceless and confused by the spectacle. The noise under and over them, thundering so that growls turned to whimpers. Tails turned under their legs. A menacing approach became a submissive retreat. We were surrounded again, but this time with protection. Royal protection at last. Horses would bring us to Ulster.
Oh, Karina, thank you for that story of magic and humanity and nature and this world and the other world. In the very best way, this story just takes me right back to being 19 years old and falling in love with these stories for the first time. And there's a way in which, I guess this is a very personal thing, but it's also just a way in which the time magic seems to be working that takes me as listener, and I'm sure so many listeners, back to that original sense of magic waking up within us and hearing it and yearning for these stories. There's some way in which you've captured that lightning in a bottle in this story and in all your stories. So thank you.
We need it, don't we? We need the magic, and we know it when we meet it, you know? I mean, I don't know if everybody recognizes it. I would wish for that, but we do think when the fire's lit, like, you know it. Inside, you know it.
Yeah. Well, and it's that fire lit within of the magic. And it's also that sense of, you know, leaning in around the fireside and say, tell me another one. Tell me another one. Take me further in. So this is one of your favorite stories, you say. What is it about this?
Well, I love horses for starters. And that would be the first reason. It's a good question. You know, why is it my favorite story? I suppose I used, you know, all those rituals like that, you know, the protections. I knew that Cormac McCart had woven 5 spells of protection. That's in the literature, you know,
right.
And the kinds of spells they are. But the actual way I've described them, I mean, I made it up. And that was great fun, like making things up. And I'm always making things up. Sometimes if I don't know the answer, I'll make it up.
Of course.
But why do I love it? Another thing about that story is when I was in Clare Island one year, I decided to go for a walk. And I went from one part of the island all around by the cliffs. And then I said, oh no, there's the lighthouse. I'm going to walk up there. And I had to go walk through a few fields of fern. And it was very, very challenging. So that's in the story as well. So personal experience, I suppose.
Yes.
And then the other piece is, I just think sacrifice is a huge theme within that story.
Mm-hmm.
To be serious, more serious about it, sacrifice is a huge theme within that story. There's many sacrifices, ritualistic sacrifices, but real ones as well. Like we make for our children. We make sacrifices for our children all the time. And I mean, I should say beautiful sacrifices as opposed to it being a wrong thing, as opposed to be an impoverishment in any way, because I don't think it is.
Yeah. And you do such a brilliant job of Octon's mother in this story, but she's daughter and she's beekeeper. And it's so very vivid what life she had before she fell in love. And it was in that grove. She lived a very different, very connected life of her own that didn't seem to yet imagine motherhood. And she was transformed so utterly by it without a grudge. It was a willing sort of sacrifice, but in every moment, it seemed like with every step, she was aware of how she was being changed and what was being lost and what was being learned and gained.
True. Well spotted, that's good. And the idea, I suppose, of the provinces sit inside that as well. In that Connacht, you know, being the kind of the province of poetry and wisdom, and then Ulster of war, which is very unfair on Ulster, I think. You know, we haven't shared it out at all. Mm-hmm. But that would be, you know, if there was ever such a thing as a chronology to it all, that would be post-Tawn. So they would have had war at that point. So the land of milk and honey.
Yes, that, the place where she'd love to keep him safe and keep him protected. And then that knowing that that's not the way of life itself. And that's contained in so many of your stories. This is, okay, here's a moment in time, a moment in a handful of lives, but you're always speaking to the greater sacrifice. You're speaking, I mean, I was just so aware of, in reading the stories previous to this one in the collection, there's that sense of an awareness of how it is we live upon the earth and how we live in relationship with the land itself and with the balance of nature. It just seems to come through so clearly as the lessons of 2,000 years ago, and so very surely the lessons we need today.
We really do, don't we?
Yeah.
I used to be fascinated as to why the end of a story ended with the woman giving birth to a boy and, like, you know, almost like a bit cross with it, until I came across the word sacrifice, meaning to make sacred.
Yes.
And the woman gets to make the child sacred.
Mm.
And the child, if we don't see that, I mean, I think maybe every parent who loves their child does know that, but collectively we seem to lose our way so much from that is sacred. I mean, you have maybe presidents going Catholic or Protestant or whatever, going to mass on Christmas Day to make a child sacred and then press a button and bomb them. It's amazing. That's like, and also in that story is that idea of legislating for your great grandchildren.
Yes.
To make the child sacred.
And how she was so aware, was it the depth of her well? She knew, yes, my well ran deep. Like there was that awareness in Ogden of saying, I know what this act of making sacred is. And it's not some, I didn't fall into this. This was who I already was before. And this is what motherhood is. And this is who I've always meant to be.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me about this story was the way that just in your description of art, like it's such a powerful and beautiful description of the sovereign, of who a true king could be. And I feel like in the same way that we sort of lose track of what it is, what it means to give birth and to be making the child sacred, that's rooted in the sense that these stories of sovereignty have a sacred king at their heart, not because of inherited power, not because he was born at the right time and he happened to bear the crown, but because you so clearly show how he embodies that. Well, I'm going to use the word magic, and I think it's exactly that and bigger than that all at the same time in terms of the energy he comes with.
Making the earth sacred, I suppose, is ultimately the awareness and that awakeness that seems to be. That was like, if you take native indigenous peoples, somebody said to Native Americans a very long time ago, would they sell their land? They'd have laughed at the idea of anybody owning land. It's like, I don't know. I mean, this is in all the myths. This, you know, the goddess is the earth. Everything is the earth. If only we would read those like that, because they can be so misinterpreted.
Yes. A huge amount of my work in the last few years has been spent being with this word sovereignty and how it's been so misunderstood and misappropriated and turned people into these, you know, I think there's an element in this. What did Ogden's father say to her about essentially relying on herself, right?
You have everything when you have yourself.
Yes. And that sense of, I think that truly is sovereignty in sort of a taking it through the traditional sacred lines of it, but we've turned it into something rather different in the 21st century that's turned us into these Well, I'm certainly Americans and the rugged individualism and all that nonsense that's come through the national myth on this side of the ocean is part of that. But I think it's infected global consciousness in so many ways.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of, you know, the sovereign is somebody who inherits and has entitlements. And really, it's the opposite, you know, it's the opposite. And funny enough, I think Queen Elizabeth II actually did seem to live within her gasa, her taboo curses or whatever it is. She seemed to live within them for the very most part, you know. She lived within what it takes to be a sovereign.
Yeah, and the crown was allowed to be heavy. The crown was meant to be heavy because it represented so much.
Exactly, yeah. And she wasn't to have opinions. She was to, it's like, you know, I'm not going to tell this because I know I couldn't tell it exactly. You know, the King Conor Mór?
Say more about that.
King Conor Mór, he was the child of Mas Buchla.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the child of Aton. Mm-hmm. And she was raped, I suppose, by the god Lu, I think, but it was a bird man anyway. And he told her she would have a son and that he would be king and that he was never to kill birds. Mm-hmm. And he's the king that walked naked to Tara. And the story goes on, and he is given all these gasa, and he has to abide by them. But the story goes on to see him break every single one of them and the destruction that comes then from there. I think he had brothers and he was lenient with them instead of not being lenient with them. Mm. Something about walking around. He couldn't walk around a castle anti-clockwise or something. You know, there was all sorts. I haven't done that story, so I don't know. I couldn't tell you, but it's a real example of having gasa and breaking them and everything going wrong, basically, you know.
Right. Well, let's explore that idea just for a second, because some of our listeners may not be familiar with this idea of the gasa.
It's like a cross between a curse and a taboo.
Yeah. So what do you think about a gasa, how we might read those now? Because in some ways they feel like a strange little motif in Celtic literature. And oh, isn't that so strange? They laid those upon each other for the purposes of plot or for superstition, or because druids were strange creatures who just liked to make things difficult. And then, of course, you know, we carry these on and we repeat them. And we kind of get a quizzical look in our eye when we're trying to say, oh, right, you know, that was that singular requirement when Fergus ended up, Deirdre and Nisha and the brothers died because Fergus had to stop and have that one meal because he couldn't refuse. What do we do with those in the now? And do you ever feel like there's a modern correspondence? Is it just a bit of a riddle? How do you play with that?
Well, I think I'm a psychotherapist. I think are you a psychotherapist as well? Are you? No.
I'm not. I just have the privilege of helping a lot of psychotherapists write. So I sit beside them an awful lot and help them tell their stories.
So being a psychotherapist has a lot of gasa. So it wouldn't be, if you fell for a client, you would have to not act on it. You know, or if the client falls for you, you have to work with that. Mm-hmm. Which is very interesting because, I mean, it's just, it's taboo, definitely taboo. And not to be broken. I don't think it should be broken ever, you know, not 2 years later or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's a taboo. And it's like, I suppose in some ways, having that and looking at it and looking at all that it entails would really make you very suspicious of falling in love in the first place. Because here you get to examine this territory, you know, and how unreliable it is, really, you know, this falling in love. Yeah. But, you know, we don't have control over that most of the time, only within the therapeutic situation. I'm just thinking, what else? You know, like, yeah, exploring boundaries all the time in that. Where else now? Can you think of anywhere that the gases are in today's world, apart from with royalty? So the queen.
Right. I mean, I can think of, you know, there's that sense of sacred limits. Like, so what if we pulled this all the way back and we know that we're living in an atmosphere that has been so thrown off by jet fuel and our cars and everything else. And we're at this point of saying, like, we're putting too much carbon out into the atmosphere. And we're warned if we get beyond this degree Fahrenheit and increase, there could be some sort of tipping point. We know that, you know, it could move the whole Gulf Stream, so that the climate of Ireland itself could become completely different if not for the ways those warm waters come across the Atlantic. And it feels almost as if we're in this age of saying, ha, dare ya. Ah, we'll figure it out. We got this. We're too powerful. The hubris and the sense of sovereignty perhaps gone amok that says it's about individual rights to determination rather than being part of this great web, married to the land, here to live in absolute reciprocity with her. I wonder if on the grandest scale, we're sort of just saying, ah, Gasa, don't hold me any longer. I'm a modern, we're a modern culture.
Very true, very true. And with that, we're sort of trying to teach our children, no, you can't have that. No, you can't have that. No, you can't have that, where we can have everything we want. And it's being able to say to ourselves, no, you can't have that. You know, you can't have that. There's a limit here and we have to live within it. And it's funny because I think a lot of people are living within the limits. What's happening, I think, is that we have too many people with power, too many wealthy people with power. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the balance has all gone astray in that people are very rich and very poor. And the very poor people are being told, no, you can't have that. You can't have peace. You can't have food. You can't have comfortable life. So it's not that people don't or aren't able, it's just that it's out of balance, I suppose. And you know, you live in the States and I live in Ireland, so we're very privileged people to have to not be hungry and not be, you know, aren't we?
Right. And then there's that funny thing where, right, the pantry's full of food, but don't eat too much of it. And that modern sort of in places of privilege and abundance, and then that, you know, you sort of, especially watching children raised in a sense of like, well, there's, you know, there's enough food to feed 14 people for 3 months in there, but you can't eat it all at once. And I'm sure, you know, that sense of living within your harvest and living within the your own comfort and your own skin has certainly been a long story. But I watch it in raising daughters and what that's like to sort of say, okay, but have it, but not too much. And where should you should know where your limits are, but I don't want to impinge them on you. And I don't want to give you an eating disorder and all those little things that are part of the calculus of modern motherhood and perhaps always have been.
I think we're afraid of our children though, a little bit nowadays. That sort of, I think it's absolutely fine to say to a 12-year-old, that's, you've had one slice of cake now, you're not getting another one, that's enough. It's not good, right. Or whatever, without the fear of creating an eating disorder. And what I've come across is the parents, something that I never experienced bringing up children, I didn't experience a fear of my child committing suicide.
Yeah.
And nowadays, the parents are living in fear of their child committing suicide. Mm. And so the children know their parents are, whether they know it cognitively or, you know, implicitly somehow, they know their parents are afraid. So they now have power over their parents because of this. And it's just terrifying because they don't take no for, Jesus, I completely took no for an answer as a child. And my kids took no for an answer. Sometimes it was absolute, a complete showdown.
Right. Yeah.
But they had to take no for an answer eventually. If they were too young to go somewhere and I was saying no and they were berating me or whatever, it happened plenty of times. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a fear of suicide, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. And I feel that so viscerally. And it's one of those it's almost like this unspoken taboo of saying, oh, we're living in an age of, we're at the edge of that taboo, potentially. And what is it like to say, because there's so much in the story about living in accordance to the patterns of nature. And now it feels so out of balance that you could potentially be living with this beautiful, perfect, sacred, ticking time bomb of a child who might not be okay. And that ultimate worst possible thing could in fact happen. It's not only in our imagination, but it's happened if not next door, then at least the next town over. And we've read too many of the stories. Yeah. So how do we, I mean, here's the impossible question. How do we get back into balance? How do we get back into the patterns of nature that says parents, children, relationship, survival? And without saying the wolves may be within rather than outside the door. It's not an army across the border. It's the demons inside.
We need protections these days again.
Yeah.
We need protections woven around us against social media and protections woven around us against, yeah, all of the information that is unnecessary for children to grow up. Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't want to sort of, yeah, we're going to a dark place now. We've gone to a dark place, I suppose, is the truth of it. Yeah, and that's dark and that's worrying. And I do think that my heart bleeds for parents at the moment. I think it's very, very difficult time to bring up children, very difficult time. And will it change? I don't know. I think, you know, it's almost like parents, with all the fear, can affect the confidence, maybe.
Yeah.
It can affect the confidence.
Right.
Then there was something in the story where she had confidence, didn't she? She had confidence, even though, and her father had given her confidence. And that's another piece today, fathering. Mm. Fathering is, I want to say it loud and clear, fathering is so important.
Yeah.
And, you know, when a mother has a baby, the father needs to look after the mother.
Mm-hmm.
Rest assured, Dad, you are really needed here. You are really needed.
Yes.
As time will go on, your role will be very, very, very important. And I think it's I don't know that men know that enough.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
They don't know that enough.
Right.
I remember, and I don't ask me now to tell you the resources or the references, because I can't, but I remember being at a talk years ago and talking about ancient rituals when young people came to puberty.
Mm-hmm.
And when the young girl, this is like way back when the young girl came to puberty, she was taken outside the village by the women. She was put into a sweat lodge and washed and stripped and put into a sweat lodge and left there until she came up with her own epiphany.
Mm.
And so it's almost like finding her own self, I suppose. And the boy, and this sounds totally violent, but we'll kind of maybe, the boy was taken off from the land of the women, mm-hmm. and beaten within an inch of his life. Now that's very, well, beaten within an inch of his life so that he could ride off with the men.
Mm-hmm.
So something about that, and obviously we don't want to beat young boys within an inch of their lives. It's nothing like that. If we look at it metaphorically, though,
right.
You're sort of bringing the man or the boy on an adventure,
mm-hmm.
and giving the masculine to himself. Now, I think the girls need that as well. Mm-hmm. And the boys need the other. It's a feminine masculine piece. But the adventure is so important. And I don't know, would they be looking at the internet as much if they were off on adventures, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I've been hearing that as a kind of a rising chorus, really, as ritual, as part of the answer and as part of what we're so very much missing. Of course, in this story, we have these five rituals of protection. And now we sort of look back on that and say, oh, well, you know, we've got antibiotics and we've got life insurance and we've got our protections and we're grand. But I've been hearing this as a really beautiful sort of repeating chorus that we're really, what we've missed from Indigenous cultures, from First Nations people, and in terms of, and I was hearing this just yesterday, I was listening to a course through Advaya on contemporary spirituality, and an Indigenous elder had said, we don't have time for everyone to go through their own private healing processes of all of the individual and collective trauma. Nothing against psychotherapy, of course, but in that sense of knowing that we are all so much caught in our own traumatic stories. And that this elder said, you know, There's not enough time for that. There's too much that's going wrong right now. We need collective ritual and to find ways to process all that's been happening to us together as community. Because this amount of time it takes for each person to go through their process alone or in partnership, perhaps we'll reach the end of that because there's so much with a beautiful burning world right now. How do we find ways to get back to the older way?
You're right. And we don't have time. And as you're talking, I'm kind of thinking, you know, in terms of these rituals for talking back. I mean, people died at 35, I suppose. So you were at 13 ready for babies. But the idea of a ritual is like, wake up. It's saying, wake up, be alive.
Yeah.
Alive. Shit's going to happen. It's going to happen to you, it happened to me. It's going to happen. But let's be alive when things happen and let's not go asleep. And I think that's beautiful. And that's what you said at the beginning of the session. It's like, you know, in terms of the magic within the myths, it actually wakes you up. That's what it does. It awakens any little spark, or even, you know, like I said before, I love horses and the sound of them and the looking at them wakes me up. It actually wakes me up. And I don't mean literally. I mean, it wakes me up inside. Yes. There's something massive in it, you know, for me. Yes. And everybody's got that. Everybody's got some form of that, don't they? What wakes you up? You know, what wakes you up? Isn't that lovely?
So I was just on vacation with my family and my 10-year-old and I went horseback riding on the beach and we galloped through the ocean. And I can still, it was this brief experience. It was all too short, but there was this moment of saying something in me came alive. And it was this, I've been dreaming of Mananon since I came home. He's the god of the sea. Like it was this sense of, you know, I'm on a tropical island thousands of miles from Irish shores with my American daughter. And it was this sudden coming together of mythic consciousness and this very real world, very privileged thing that I got to do as a tourist in Jamaica. But that sense of saying in that moment, it was like my soul recognized something that was so deep and ancient and a calling. And that happened to occur on a modern American holiday in a foreign country. But that waking up.
That used to be an everyday. A long time ago, that was an everyday. And it's still an everyday for, I mean, the people I live around me, I used to live in Dublin and I'm from Kilkenny City. I grew up over a pub, but like then I went to Dublin. I lived there most of my life, brought my kids up there. And then 3 years ago, I came to the country because I couldn't afford to live in Dublin and to finish paying for my house. And so I came down the country and bought this beautiful house, didn't think it through. On any level did I think it through, what it was going to entail. So it has been an adventure ever since. And I love it. I absolutely love it now, I can say. You know, it's taken a while. I mean, so many nights I woke up and going, what am I doing here in the middle of the country? But you see, I mean, it's hardship for some. Mm-hmm. But they're alive. Yeah. They're all alive. It's like, you know, they're alive to the weather all the time. They might be cursing about it, but they're alive and awake to it all the time. And it's always a challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's adventure in a way, isn't it? That's kind of adventure.
Yeah.
You have to carry wood. You have to feed an animal. You have to, all of those things. You know, I came across these books one time in UCD Library. One book, sorry. And it was for teachers back in the day, way back in the day. And it was talking about the different books you gave to children. Mm-hmm. And the first was the rhythmic phase where, you know, children, you might in the garden, la da 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 da, and the rhythmic phase. And we both read to our children at that time where they'll say, read it again. They want it again. They want it the next night.
Yeah.
The rhythmic phase. And then the fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that which is probably why I write myths, the fairy tale is so that you can go into magic land and come back. Mm. And so that's my grandchild says, somebody said, "Oh, are you Superman?" And he said, "No, I'm Frank dressed up as Superman." So he's both, you know, and he knows he's. And I went to the fairy tale and never came back, basically, you know, escaped from life as it was. And so the fairy tale stage is to teach you to go there and back again. And then the next phase is the adventure phase. So you could say Huckleberry Finn and the Famous Five or God knows. And then the next phase is the romantic phase. And the trouble with girls and boys, I think, but particularly worrying about girls, they skip, they go from the fairy tale into the romantic, skip the adventure. And it's really, really, really important not to skip the adventure, you know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate that. So I have children who are 14 and 10 right now, and both of them have become absolutely entranced with the Greek myths because of the Rick Riordan and Percy Jackson series of books. And those are brutal stories. You know, it's really interesting to say, at first my older daughter was first listening to them. I'm like, oh, these are just, they're so PG-13 and they're so masculine. And now as I think I'm watching my second child really fall in love with these stories too, it's this like, oh, there's a gift here that's giving you a chance that our culture may often try to take from girls because it's too quick into Taylor Swift and all the rest of it a little too fast. And that's the way that myth is getting in, I think, for this generation right now. There's always a few luminary writers in any generation, right? That can be a voice that take the mythic minded to that next, well, into the other world, and then to see whether they come back or not.
And those books, in a way, are adventures.
Yeah.
You know, they are adventures and they like to meet danger. You know, young people like to meet danger in their, I mean, fairy tales are very frightening, but somehow children seem to love them. I suppose they meet their own darker nature. The fairy tale meets the child's own darker nature, I think, which is a bit of a relief because they will have wished their sister dead and, you know, all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Abandoned. with abandon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I started to tell my grandson a story the other day, a fairy tale, and I practically got a fright. I think I got a fright to see the difference between a book and telling him a story. He got a little enchantment came upon his face, complete and utter concentration. And it was... I suppose I got a fright because I thought, oh God, is this going to be good for him or bad for him or whatever, you know, because he was so open to the story, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
You know where I think we've just landed in the midst of our conversation when we got to the very dark nature of, you know, fear of our children's lives and the danger they could be under at their own hand. And we've just landed on the medicine here. We're naming the power of story, of adventure, of the other world. Of, I think people might laugh to say, wait, Karina Tynan was afraid of what a story might do to her young grandson? What? Because, but that's the power of it. In that moment, oh, have we gone too far? Oh, no, wait, was this exactly what he needed? And will that be that moment he'll always hold on to with his grandmother? That said, she took me to the other world and then I knew what it was like and it was okay.
Yeah. And it was okay, yeah. But it's a lot to have in your hands, isn't it?
It is.
Being a mother is one thing in that you're so busy with children and all the worries and all the things that you don't get time for the miracle that you do when you're a grandmother. I mean, it is miraculous.
Yeah.
And so is every child. And that, I want to cry now when I think about that, because I think about all that's happening to children at the moment, you know.
Oh, Karina, I feel like we could talk for days. I know I'd love to sit with you about every story you've ever written. I feel like we could explore so much. But as we say farewell today, are there any sort of last thoughts about this story or about myth and story generally you'd like to leave us with as we say farewell?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, I suppose, for a wonderful conversation in that the way you seem to be able to look from a distance and capture you know, kind of no matter how far it goes away into different directions, you seem to be able to hold the thing, which is quite a talent, I have to say. Especially with me, because I go on awful tangents and make things up and do everything, you know. So that's been great. Have I anything else to say? No, just that it's lovely to talk with you about myth, because it's on one side it needs to be lonely, and on the other side it needs to have company. You know, you have to go in, but then to come out and talk, and it's lovely to meet a kindred spirit. I think that's important. Yeah. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Karina. Yes, kindred spirits for certain. Yeah, I feel like you've been holding my hand across the decades, even though we've only just had a chance to meet. So thank you. I would love for you to tell people a bit more about where they can find you and your work and the books.
Sure. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the books are only for sale in Ireland in shops, so I can't tell you where to get them in the USA. I have them online you can buy them on my website, which is Karina with a K, Karina Tynan, TYNAN.com. And I'm also on Instagram. It's called Irish Myths Retold. And yeah, if anybody's in Dublin, I'm doing a reading in Hodges Figgis on the 8th of May at 6 p.m. Hodges Figgis in Dawson Street. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it. And just to say, books are illustrated by my daughter, Cathy Tynan .net. She's a beautiful Dublin artist. And the book is designed by my niece, Ruby Henderson. So yeah, which is amazing.
Oh, yes, I love that it's such a family affair. It's a community in the making, because I so recommend that people, you know, hey, it's a bit of shipping across the ocean, but the feel of this book in my hands, it just has this sense of, and again, I'll just call myself back to this, myself in 2000, like I just feel her holding on to this, like, and probably would have picked it up in Hodges Figgis once upon a time. I love that bookstore.
Yeah. It's and they are, there's Tawn as well, as the other book is Tawn, the Women's Stories, which is my first book. But they are beautiful objects. Mm. They are expensive. They're €25 each, and they are expensive, and so is postage. Yeah. But they are beautiful as well. I think it's nice.
Yes.
I'm proud of them anyway.
For certain. Yeah. For certain. Well, Karina, this has been such a treat and such an honor. I'm so grateful to you for coming on the show. Mila Buikas.
Thank you, Marissa. Thank you very much. Gaurav Mahagat.